Many people become interested in indigenous spiritual wisdom, but regarding today's guest, anthropologist, author, and teacher Hank Wesselman, I want to say the shamanic spiritual wisdom showed itself to be interested in him. A proficient student of walking between the worlds, Hank has an enormous understanding to share with us all. Part one today, I'm Robin with Tributaries. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Would you introduce us to your work via your initial visionary experiences?
I actually began to have visionary experiences when I was a little boy. I grew up in New York City, and my mother or my au pair used to take me to Central Park. And, you know, I guess I was about 3 or 4 years old when I suddenly realized that the pigeons and the squirrels and the trees were living beings like myself, but they were different. And then, of course, there was the zoo, the Central Park Zoo. And I really, really enjoyed going and seeing the animals. And one day, I saw an animal in a cage that just took my breath away. It was a leopard. And it was, without doubt, the most incredibly beautiful creature I'd ever seen in my life. On that day, the leopard, pacing in its cage, suddenly stopped and looked into my eyes, and something happened. And suddenly, the best way I can describe this is that we found ourselves in a place where there were no bars. It was a blue place, a place of blueness. And the leopard and I were there together, and something happened. And as I reach for that happening all these years later, it eludes me. But the leopard became kind of like my imaginary friend, and because he often stood up on his hind legs to sort of mimic the way I stood up on my legs, I came to think of him as the Leopard Man. And it was kind of like, do you remember that cartoon strip, Calvin and Hobbes? Calvin's the little boy, and Hobbes is his stuffed tiger, but
yes.
For Calvin, Hobbes was real, and they had adventures together. Well, that's what my relationship with this leopard man was like, and I didn't know him as a spirit. I didn't know anything about spirits at that time. But, you know, he was my friend for years, and then, of course, when I grew up, he kind of withdrew and disappeared into the past. But I became a life scientist because of my connections with nature. And when I went into the Peace Corps in Nigeria for 2 years, in 64 to 66, I lived with people of the Yoruba culture who had a polytheistic tradition based on over 300 gods called Orisha in their tradition. And, you know, I was fascinated by my connections with this indigenous spiritual practice. And little did I know that some of these transpersonal forces that they called Orisha took an interest in me and followed me for the rest of my life. And they're still with me. But it was, you know, like, oh, my goodness, 10 years after that, when I found myself in Ethiopia for my doctoral research as part of a safari camp. Okay, I was living in a tented camp 600 miles from the nearest cold beer or hot bath. And it was out there in the desert doing survey work and archaeology and paleontology. And it was really Indiana Jones work, you know. I began to have these visions, and I had no idea what they were. Sometimes they happened at night when I was asleep, and I would have classic out-of-the-body experiences. And then sometimes they happened in the daytime when I was very much awake. And I remember one particular day, which I'll share with you. I think this was in August in 1972. It was about 115 degrees. And I had a team of three African men and myself, and we were excavating a site which was over 3 million years old. And it had the fossils of, you know, monkeys and buffaloes and antelopes and crocodiles and turtles. And scattered among these fossilized remains were the bits and pieces of an early kind of human called Australopithecus. That was the goal. We were in search of answers to the mystery of human origins through the investigation of the fossilized remains preserved in the Great Rift Valley. This was in southwestern Ethiopia, as I've said. And on that particular day, I remember getting this feeling, this overwhelming feeling that I was being watched by something. Now, when you're 100 yards from the Land Rover, okay, and there are lions and leopards and buffaloes and hyenas, you know, these are all dangerous creatures. So being aware that you're being watched by something is a kind of creepy feeling. And I remember standing up very slowly and kind of dusting myself off. And two of the African men, members of the Wakamba tribe from Kenya, were loading up the Land Rover with the expedition equipment. But there was a third man who was part of my team called Atiko. And Atiko was a shaman. He was a member of the Dasnech tribe, a pastoralist nomadic society that lives north of Lake Turkana, across the border from Kenya into southwestern Ethiopia. And Atiko was a shaman, and I noticed that Atiko was looking at something off to my left. So I slid my eyes in that direction, and I saw something. And it was big, and it was about 6 feet off the ground. And as I looked directly at it, it's as though whatever it was stepped through a tear in the fabric of the air and then zipped it closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out, and then it was gone. Now, in looking at this complex, what remains with me today is that I saw these interesting dots, and I'm standing there thinking to myself, gee, you know, maybe it's time to go back to Nairobi and have a hamburger and a beer. Hallucinations in the desert. Okay, I slid my eyes over to the shaman, and Atiko was watching me. And in those moments, I knew that he'd seen it. And he knew that I'd seen it. And I knew that he knew that I'd seen it.
Right.
And so I asked him a question in Swahili. I asked him, Atiko, what was that? And he gave me this very measured look, and then he smiled, and he pointed directly at the place where this thing had been and said a single word in Swahili, the word Shaitani. Shaitani is the Swahili word for spirit. Now, in those days, I didn't know anything about spirits or soul or anything. You know, I worshipped solely at the altar of science. And so I stashed this memory. I wrote cryptic notes to myself in my journal, and I stashed this memory. And then 10 years later, when I was finishing my doctoral dissertation in Berkeley, I had the chance to take a workshop with another anthropologist named Michael Harner. And on that occasion, many of your listeners, I'm sure, know him and his foundation. On that occasion, we did an exercise in which we were paired up with somebody we didn't know. And the goal was to do a shamanic journey, which is a form of meditation, a journey into the other world, into the world of things hidden, to find a helping spirit for your partner. Now, the woman with whom I was paired up was this very slender, dark-haired woman with dark eyes and long hair named Sandra Ingerman.
What a coincidence,
eh? And on that occasion, I didn't know who she was. She was a grad student at the CIIS in San Francisco in counseling psychology. And I was a grad student at Berkeley in anthropology. And so there I am on the flat on my back in this high school gymnasium in the dark with Michael Harner blaming away on his drum, helping us achieve altered states. And I'm worried. I'm thinking, oh, my God, what if she doesn't find anything? And then she sits up in the middle of this journey and gives me this intense look. And she leans over and places her mouth on my chest and blows into my heart. And something happened, this warm, prickly, goosebumpy response. She blew again and then sat me up and blew into the top of my head. And at the end of the journey, she described going into the other world, into the spirit world, where she encountered a being that said it was one of my old friends. And then in front of me, she describes encountering the leopard man. Now, you know, just talking to you over the phone about this, I've got goosebumps down to my knees. I remember that moment well, and it was the beginning of the rest of my connection with the shamanist tradition. You'll notice I use the word shamanist. In my most recent book, The Reenchantment, I've suggested, you know, that since those who follow the Buddhist path call themselves Buddhists, and those who follow the way of Tao call themselves Taoists, I think those of us who walk the shaman's path could call ourselves shamanists. It's well known that nobody in the shamanic tradition calls themselves a shaman. It just isn't done. It's considered to be spiritual arrogance. So for me and for others as well, it's always been kind of a red flag when somebody comes right out front and announces that they're a shaman. It isn't done.
Understood,
but I've been on this
yes.
path now for over 40 years, and I've had this incredible life in response. And a lot of my books describe what happened in response to coming into this tradition.
Yes, and I thank you for bringing up that point about how a shaman would not call himself a shaman. I think that's an important thing, especially in this day and age, for people to know. And to
well, you know, shamans, in my experience, I've lived with over 12 different indigenous cultures, many of which were traditional cultures, traditional in the sense that they had not been westernized. You know, when I was living in the Omo Valley, we were the only outsiders that the people who lived in that region had ever seen. These were really traditional people. Okay. It was my experience that shamans tend to be very humble people. You know, if you and I went down to Oaxaca in Mexico and we wanted to meet some shamans, you know, you don't go around asking people, gee, we'd like to meet some shamans. Do you know any shamans around here? Because nobody would tell you anything because they don't know who you are. But, you know, after you've been down there for 2 or 3 weeks, if you went to an elder and said, you know, I need a healing. Do you know anybody around here who does healings? And the elder's eyebrows would probably shoot up and say, oh, you should go see Doña Maria. She healed my father of the wasting disease. This is what people sometimes call cancer. And, you know, this is one of the ways in which you can encounter traditional shamans. So when you go and you meet Doña Maria and you ask her, Doña Maria, you know, I'm in search of a shaman. Are you a shaman? She'll look very embarrassed and say, well, no, I'm a weaver. It was my grandmother who was the shaman.
Right.
She was the one with the gift. In other words, nobody ever claims it.
One more thing I'd like to mention before we move on. In that time in Africa, you spoke about having the out-of-body experience and watching above from your bed where you were sleeping, and then you would venture out flying over the encampment. And that's one thing. I know many of our listeners have had out-of-body experiences like that, but I felt like yours was taken to a whole nother level when you were brushing your teeth the next morning and someone asked you what you were doing flying over their tent.
Yeah, that got my attention.
I bet.
I thought I was just having extraordinarily vivid dreams. And then when Kombulu, the Wakamba tribesman, asked me, hey, Dr. Hank, what were you flying over my tent last night? You know, I just about dropped my toothbrush. I mean, I was really sort of stunned.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, this was the onset of a whole phase in my life. I remember when I was finishing up my doctoral degree in Berkeley, my wife Jill was expecting our first child. And I remember one night, I think it was in August in maybe 1982, she was awake in the night and all of her ligaments were loosening up for birth giving and she was in discomfort. And she was reading, and I remember sitting up in bed and massaging her and trying to help her get back to sleep. But inevitably, the magic that touch creates progressed into a joyous marital encounter, if I can put it that way, at the end of which I was absolutely euphoric, as usual, And I was just about to go back to sleep, and suddenly my physical body was invaded by these feelings of force, of energy. And this could have been quite disturbing if it wasn't so exquisitely pleasurable. In moments, my physical body was completely paralyzed. And I remember my eyelids fluttering as I looked up at the ceiling, and then everything went dark. It was kind of like I blacked out. And I found myself in this forest at night. Everything was black on black. It was at night. And as I floated through this forest in this visionary state, I could hear my wife turning the pages of her book next to me in bed. I knew I could feel the sheets around me in bed. But my conscious awareness had been relocated into someplace else. And it was in this dark forest at night that I encountered a dark being, utterly compelling, utterly black, tall, like a silhouette, head, shoulders, and then all the way down to the ground, something about 50 feet tall. And as I looked at this thing, I wondered if it could be the source of these sensations that I was feeling in my body. And this direct encounter gave me the experience of power, which was beyond my wildest imaginings. And at the end of this encounter, when it came to an end, the entire vision dissolved. This is recorded in the first chapter of my book, Spirit Walker, which has been very widely read. This was really my introduction. And, you know, looking back on it now, Robin, if I were to put it this way, I have the feeling that the guys upstairs, that's what I think of as the higher organizing intelligences. Some people call them the angelic forces. I think they got tired of waiting around for me to get what I was really supposed to come into this life to do. You know, I was on the top of the ladder of my scientific tradition. You know, grants from National Science Foundation, international research with the superstars of the paleoanthropological community. But, you know, I suddenly realized after I'd had this experience that my ladder had been leaning against the wrong wall. Mm. And I was going to have to start all over again at the bottom. And I'm still trying to work my way up. I still consider myself an apprentice after all these years. But this was the beginning of a very interesting series of visionary experiences in which my conscious awareness was drawn into connection. It was when I was living in Hawaii in 1986, 87, 88. I began to have these ongoing connections with the mind, soul, and body of another man, in which I found myself in his body, looking out through his eyes at his world, being able to tap into his thoughts. I had access to his memories and his feelings and emotions. And what made this really sticky is that this was so extraordinarily vivid on the one hand, and this is a man who lives approximately 5,000 years after the collapse of Western civilization in a world which is completely different from the one that we live in today. This is what began the book Spirit Walker and the two books that followed, Medicine Maker and Vision Seeker. And they record an ongoing series of absolutely extraordinary visionary experiences which involve time traveling. And in time, this man began to have these experiences in reverse, where he would find himself in my body, looking out through my eyes at my world. And his take on this was that I must be one of his ancestors. Well, I had never thought this, Robin. This had just never occurred to me. But if I was the ancestor and he was one of my descendants, this could be part of the causality for this experience to happen. This is really the inception of my connection with the shamanist tradition, I guess you could say. And the rest is followed from there.
As you mentioned, you were worshiping at the altar of science, and as you're explaining, the integration of that is coming into focus. Is there any one thing in particular you would share with a skeptic or someone who is overtaken by the scientific viewpoint?
I would learn that there's a difference between shamans and medicine people. All right, as you probably know, Indians don't like to be called shamans. They like to be called medicine people. And what I would learn is that medicine people tend to do their main work here in this world. They tend to be ceremonialists, ritual leaders, and many of them have great knowledge of the healing arts. Like you mentioned Ho'oponopono, which is a Hawaiian method of conflict resolution, especially working with families. So the medicine person does their main work here in this world, whereas the shaman, all right, the shaman does their main work in the other world. Indigenous people, in my experience, perceive the world as made up of two halves, the world of things seen and the world of things hidden. And they make no distinction between them. They understand that they present themselves together, mixed into one common reality. The shaman is an individual who learns, sometimes in childhood, sometimes later in life, that they have the ability to go into trance very easily. And when they go into what is we describe as an altered state of consciousness, they can relocate their conscious awareness into an alternate reality, which is virtually universally known in every culture as the spirit world. Now, the shaman is a universal figure which is found in some form in every culture in the world. And the first thing that the shamanist discovers is that this world is inhabited. It's inhabited by transpersonal forces, which traditional people call spirits. And by coming into relationship with these forces, shamans are able to do various things, initially on behalf of themselves, and then increasingly on behalf of others. The shaman is kind of like a public servant in that respect. And they're on call all the time.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
So years ago, I remember asking Michael Harner, how do you know when somebody's an authentic shaman? And he got right to the point. He said three things. First of all, do they journey to other worlds? Secondly, do they come into relationship with spirits? And thirdly, do they perform miracles? And I'm thinking specifically of healing work. You know, over the years that I've been doing this, I've been teaching at places like the Esalen Institute in California, the Omega Institute on the East Coast, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At one time, I was doing 40 workshops a year in addition to my academic teaching. What I would discover is that I could give people a set of coordinates and instruct them in the shamanic method. And in doing that, I would use the drum in order to help people alter consciousness. And I would send them off on these meditative adventures. And 15, 20 minutes later, these non-tribal Western people would come back with accounts that would pass muster at any Aboriginal campfire. And I realized that we were onto something. And through my own experience, I learned that we, in fact, may have a program on our inner hard drive. And I'm talking about our DNA, a genetic program on our inner hard drive. And when that program is double-clicked with the right mouse, it allows human beings to achieve expanded states of awareness, which are really quite extraordinary in the sense that we can perceive in a way which is not possible in our waking state. Now, you know, for the skeptic, let me just say, it's fine to be a skeptic. But when you've had that awesome jolt of the real thing, when you've encountered these transpersonal forces on their own ground, it changes you, and it changes you forever. In my experience, there are primarily three great gateways to transcendence. The first of these is meditation. And shamanic journey work is the ancient ancestral form of meditation from which all of our spiritual traditions, including our organized religions, are descended. It's the ancestor. And having seen the archaeological evidence for it, I would guess that, you know, this tradition is at least 100,000 years old, maybe older. The second major passage is through Tantra. And, you know, those who've read my Spirit Walker trilogy are aware of the fact that virtually all of my deep trance experiences happened on the heels of a joyous marital encounter. You know, the step from the tantric ecstasy to the mystical ecstasy is a very short step, and experientially they're very similar. The third major form of induction is trauma. As you pointed out, so many people who've had a traumatic injury or experience are precipitated into an altered state of consciousness in which they return with accounts which mystify doctors. For example, somebody having an open heart surgery, or somebody who dies and then is brought back, you know, 10 minutes later, they will return with these accounts. And there's remarkable congruence in these accounts. There's a formidable literature on this now. I'm currently working my way through Larry Dossey's book, One Mind, and he's done all of our research for us. He's summarized a tremendous amount of information with references for the skeptic. This is no longer a question of if this is real. We know that it's real. And since consciousness is one of our major frontiers, you know, this is worthy of investigation, I think. You know, after 2.5 million years of the evolution of the body and the brain, we're now at that point where the next stage in human evolution is going to be the evolution of consciousness. And this is rather an exciting adventure, don't you think?
Well, I think it's very exciting for me, to the point where it almost seems absurd to dissect a dead brain. What is a brain? It's trace minerals in water. Where is consciousness really coming from? You can look at the ancient texts on chakras and energy centers. And yet, there's beyond that or before that as well. And I think that's the research and the things I'm looking forward to.
Well, here's something interesting about shamans. I've mentioned that the shaman is a universal figure found in some form in virtually every culture in the world. Virtually all shamans everywhere perceive the spirit world in the same way. And this is quite striking, because there's virtually nothing that everyone everywhere agrees upon as so. You know, virtually all shamans perceive the spirit world as a layered phenomenon, with worlds above this one and worlds below this one. In that sense, the world that we're in right now is in the middle of the stack, and many people in the Western shamanic tradition refer to it as the middle world. But below this are the lower worlds, the dream worlds of nature. This is where you find the spirits of the animals and the plants and the elementals, as well as the spirits of mythical creatures like dragons and unicorns and griffins. That's where they came from into human conscious awareness.
We'll conclude with Hank Wesselman next week. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.